This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Three-pointer.
Oh, Hutchins! Double honor!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
Oh! LeBron James with no regard for human life!
Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Maddie, what are you still doing here?
Here's Matt Yoder.
The NFL Draft takes place tomorrow in Chicago. To talk about the big event and so much more, we welcome in Bleacher Report NFL Draft analyst Matt Miller to the AA Podcast. Welcome, Matt, and thanks for taking the time today on this, the eve of your Super Bowl and World Series and NBA Finals all wrapped up into one.
Yeah, it's everything. Christmas and the Super Bowl and everything, so I'm really thankful to be on. It's great to finally talk to you.
I want to get started first, before we get into the actual draft tomorrow night, to talk about Bleacher Report and your journey there. For those folks listening that may not know, I mean, with Bleacher Report's rise and Turner buying the website and getting into the mainstream, you're one of the guys there that has been homegrown, that has grown into this full-time role with a massive social media following, all these article reads. But you started out when the site was kind of still making its way and now have stayed there to the point where it's this national, really, I think you can argue, mainstream sports media outlet. So how has your writing career evolved and really coincided with this growth of Bleacher Report?
Well, I'm like just a naive like follower with it. You know, I blindly applied to Bleacher Report. I'd never heard of BR when I applied there. I had my own little independent draft website called New Era Scouting, and it was the same work I do now, just no one was reading it. I mean, we might get like 1,000 hits a month. It was good content, or I thought it was good content, but just we didn't have any way to get it out to the masses. So I worked in social media marketing for a photography lab, and I hated my job. Like, I was just miserable. So I would spend so much of my work day, like, looking for somewhere to write. Like, I didn't even want to be paid. I just wanted someone to see my work and feel like, you know, I was kind of cocky enough that if someone saw my work, I thought maybe I would have a chance to be hired. And so in late 2010, I just Googled, you know, journalism jobs, and Bleacher Report came up. And I applied. And it's like the next day, I got an email back, and they were like, you know, your writing samples look good. We don't really have anyone who covers the draft. So, yeah, we would love to bring you on. And so, like 3 months later, it was February of 2011, they brought me on part-time, started paying me a little bit, which was great because, like, it was enough to cover my rent at the time. And so my wife and I were, like, ecstatic. It was like, I get to write about football, and someone's going to pay my rent. Like, I'm pretty happy right now. And then it's been an uphill ever since that. I quit my job May of 2011, my full-time job, and BR brought me on. They announced the lead writer program in August of 2011. And it's just been like, I'm just trying to keep up now because it has, like, Bleacher Report has grown into this huge, you know, monster. And I'm just, you know, I had such an unconventional path to this that I didn't expect any of this to happen for myself or the company. So it sounds corny, but it's the truth. I just show up every day knowing that there's a version of me from 3 or 4 years ago out there who would love to take my job and would probably do it cheaper and, you know, would just be happy to have it. So I just try to work my tail off so that, you know, I can stay in this place because I'm pretty fortunate to go from, you know, no one knowing who I was a few years ago to now having a platform that I'm really grateful for.
With that in mind, has it been almost daunting to see, as you say, the monster Bleacher Report has grown into when you talk about the lead writer program and all these great bloggers that were coming in, and now the transition with Turner? Now you've got guys from the New York Times, from CBS, from all of these different outlets leaving those companies to come to Bleacher Report. I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, that would be unfathomable. So from the inside, I mean, just how much has that changed your perspective of the company that you write for, and how much does that motivate you to keep working every day, as you've said and you've kind of articulated? But just the fact that you have now all of these people coming in with these varied backgrounds across sports media with followings and resumes and things like the Times on their CV to come in now and be a part of Bleacher Report. How has that changed your focus, your perspective as someone who has been there since that beginning?
Well, I think for someone like myself, it makes you like raise your game a little bit. Like today we're doing draft rehearsals and I'm sitting by Chris Sims, who played in the NFL and, you know, has, you know, such an understanding of the game. And I like topped out in high school, you know, so I'm sitting next to the 6'4" quarterback and like, man, do I really belong here? And then in walks John Vilma, who, you know, I loved watching at the University of Miami and in the NFL, and, you know, you're just surrounded by so much expertise that it makes you step your game up a little bit. And even on the writing side, like, I read the stuff that Matt Bowen does, and I'm just like, how the heck am I going to keep up with this guy? Because he's so versatile. You know, he knows the X's and O's, but he's a fantastic writer as well. So it is tough. I mean, you have to have thick skin, and you have to be confident in your, you know, your own abilities. But at the same time, it's like a constant grind to just try to keep up with your coworkers because there's so much talent. And, you know, it has been kind of a whirlwind to keep up with, you know. And I'm not a huge fan of other sports, but when my friends tell me, like, oh, my God, you guys hired Rick Bucher, I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, okay. Like, now everyone knows where I work now, where before, like, even my friends didn't really know what Bleacher Report was. And now they're like, hey, can you get me a Bleacher Report hoodie? And, you know, like, it's been a complete change. And I think a lot of those guys, you know, on the NFL side, you know, Mike Freeman and Jason Cole and Matt Bowen and our, you know, having Chris Sims and John Vilma, it gives us a lot more credibility so that a guy like me who came from nowhere without an athletic background, I think at least that it helps my credibility to be associated with those people who are so recognized.
And the journey of the site's credibility over the last several years for a lot of folks in the sports media, let's face it, for a long time, Bleacher Report was an easy target, whether it be the slideshows or Google or what have you. Now with the money in from Turner, the investment in a lot of these legitimate mainstream guys, and really the spotlighting of that professional content that you and others bring, that it's not just a content farm anymore. Here is a lot of original things the site can offer. Do you feel prouder now to work at Bleacher Report? I mean, with this process, with Bleacher Report entering into the mainstream, is there a bit more pride in people now knowing where you work and knowing that, you know, when folks think of Bleacher Report, they're not going to think of the slideshows anymore. They're not going to think of Deadspin and the criticism or whatever. They're going to think, hey, yeah, that's a mainstream site. That's a site that has legit stuff. That's a site that deserves to have Marv Albert and Jim Nantz read ads during the NCAA tournament. That's a site that belongs with the ESPNs and Fox Sports and Sports Illustrateds of the world.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. I am, like, blissfully naive about a lot of how, you know, media working. So, like, when I came in, it was just like, hey, we really like this slideshow format, and where I do a lot of like mock drafts and rankings, it actually appealed to me, you know, that presentation, because I would look at other mock drafts and it would be like, you know, here's the pick that's going to happen and here's one sentence about why that pick makes sense. But because of the slideshow, I was able to write like 3 and 4 paragraphs justifying, you know, talking about scheme fit. So the slideshow actually appealed to me. I never really understood the criticism there, and I still struggle with it at times to understand why people push back against it so hard. But I mean, I was so proud to work at Bleacher Report just because I was able to say, you know, I got a full-time job writing about football, and I went to college to be a paramedic, not journalism school. So it was always a big deal to me regardless. But I think now, you know, it's nice when you go somewhere and people, you know, if I'm wearing a Bleacher Report shirt, people are like, oh man, I have your app and I love it. Yeah, I mean, that makes you feel pretty good at the end of the day, but I would say that I've always been pretty proud of where I work just because it was a huge accomplishment for me. And then to see where the company has gone, just, I mean, it makes you feel pretty good about the people who are in charge.
So what do you think is in the future of Bleacher Report before we transition to the draft? Do you think there's still some room to grow and some room to become even more of a mainstream company? Do you think there's still some areas that the company can look to invest in that can take it to a next level? How do you see the next maybe 12 to 24 months continuing that evolution of Bleacher Report, where we've really, I mean, just from the outside media observer standpoint, we've really seen the company and the perception of the company be transformed in the last 2 years. How do you see that next step playing out in those next 1 to 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, you might even have a better feel than I do for that. But I would think that, you know, to see a continued push for, you know, our TeamStream app is such a major part of what we do now. So I would think trying to stay, you know, attack that mobile generation, you know, I mean, I have a 14-year-old daughter who doesn't even watch TV. She's on her phone all the time. And I would think that that generation younger than myself, that's where we're going to get them, is on their phones. So I think continuing to grow TeamStream, you know, the video element has really blown up in the time I've been here. It started for me with a webcam on my laptop, and now I have a complete video studio in my home office. So
wow.
I would think that that vertical is going to grow a lot as well, you know, as we try to capitalize on, you know, being able to do quick hitters for every team. You know, I think that's one of the beauties of TeamStream is that, you know, like I grew up a Texas Longhorns fan, and watching SportsCenter, you're not always going to get analysis about them, but one of the cool things about TeamStream is you're always going to get that analysis. Or like the Kansas City Royals right now, man, I can't see Royal highlights anywhere, but TeamStream, I get articles and video and tweets, so it's really, I think, you know, a pretty innovative way to consume sports, so I would think we would do everything we can to grow that.
All right, let's move to the draft now, and first, your job as a draft analyst, I think people might look at this and say, wow, you can spend 24/7, 365 around the clock on the NFL draft. Yes, you can. How big has this industry of being a draft analyst and all of the coverage and interest and scrutiny and analysis and everything that goes into this event that only takes now 3 days, 7 rounds, it's, you know, the same as it's been for a while. But just how has this industry of draft analysis and coverage really exploded in the last several years?
It's huge. I mean, you can look at what we do or the fact that they're taking over, you know, downtown Chicago for the actual draft. I mean, I think that over the past few years, we've seen fans become a lot more aware of the draft and more aware of the hopes and dreams of the draft. And that's one thing that, when I, you know, came to Bleacher Report, was selling them on the idea, and they were very receptive to this. They knew it already, that the draft is year-round. And it's something that we talk about, you know, this weekend. But I'll go home, and I've already started watching film for next year's draft. So people, one of the biggest articles that I write every year is the morning after the draft. It's that look ahead to next year.
That's amazing.
People already want to know, you know, what's going on, you know, who should I be watching, and it's kind of crazy, but at the same time, it's amazing, because, you know, it's that everyone wants to be informed and know what's happening, so they want that early watch list, but it never really stops, that's for sure.
And I guess along with that, you mentioned watching film for the next year. What is a day in the life of a draft analyst like? How much time are you working on player rankings, mock drafts? You mentioned watching film. How many hours does that take? I mean, I know this week is probably very, very unique since the actual draft is taking place tomorrow. But just throughout the year, I mean, you know, a Wednesday in October, a Monday in June, what are those days like for a draft analyst?
Well, October is a lot different than June for me. I try not to work much between like May 15th and August 15th. I try to take a little time off. But a normal day for me is, you know, starting around 7:30, and I, you know, check my emails, check Twitter, see if any news broke, or, you know, try to respond to questions to start my day. And then a lot of times I'm doing video for at least an hour every morning. From my home studio, we do everything remote, straight to New York. And then a lot of time is carved out for radio as well. You know, regional, national hits. We definitely have to do a lot of that. And then the rest of the time would be, depending on if I have a deadline that I'm working against, I may write for 5 or 6 hours a day. I may watch film for 5 or 6 hours a day. I write around 3 articles a week. So on the days that I don't write, I'm watching film. And during the season, I work 7 days a week. There's no day off, because Saturdays are college football, obviously. And then Sundays during the season, I cover the NFL from a national perspective. So it's 7 days a week, and it's a lot of 10 and 12 hour days, but it is still, you know, you're watching, I would say, 30 to 35 hours of football during a normal week during the season, because there's just so much to stay caught up on.
With your draft rankings and watching all that film and putting together a board and looking at all the strengths and weaknesses of players, are there certain qualities that you look forward to say, this is why I have this guy ahead of this one? You know, what separates maybe a 10th ranked linebacker from an 11th ranked linebacker? Just how much goes into that moving around of the rankings, of the mock drafts, of everything else? Because I think those of us that aren't in it 365, 24/7, we might look at it and say, you know, how do you come up with tangible quantitative things to try to rank these players? Do you have a science, a system? How does that process play out for you?
You know, it is tough. I don't know that there's always, like you said, a quantitative way to say, this is why, you know, Kevin White is number one and Amari Cooper is number two. Sometimes it is just instinct. And I know there's a push for more analytics in draft study. And that's a hard thing, because I think it does come down to preference a lot of times. I try to look at it, you know, when I'm stacking my big board of, if I were in charge of a team with no players, you know, like an expansion team, who would I draft? And so this year I would draft Jameis Winston first. Easy decision. But that's probably the easiest way for me to look at it, because otherwise you start to get into a lot of secondary questions that could throw things off. But, I mean, to your original question, how do you separate guys? I think sometimes it's by size. Sometimes it's by athleticism. Sometimes it's by an injury history or a character concern, you know, something off the field that might hurt the player. And then sometimes it's as simple as, you know, stats or production, level of competition. But there is a lot that goes into it. And I'm like crazy about adjusting my board. If they would let me, I would probably adjust it today, just because you constantly are thinking about things, you know, of, well, you know, Dante Fowler versus Vic Beasley, you know, why do I have one over the other? And you can definitely talk yourself into making changes. So it's kind of nice to have a deadline of, hey, we need this to be done by this date. So I would have to set the thing and leave it alone for about a week, which is probably a good thing for me.
I think one of the toughest things that we look at when we look at mock drafts and draft projections is the knowledge that, you know, a good mock draft is probably only going to hit exactly on 25%, 30% of the first round picks. You go through rounds 5, 6, 7, those 7-round mock drafts. I mean, you even wonder, you know, how is this really going to play itself out? Maybe you get one pick, just like winning the lottery. That is an exact connection. So when you look at the mock drafts, where you have players rated, what for you is a successful projection? Are you looking at, you know, slotting those mock drafts picks correctly? Are you looking at, you know, this is a guy that I kind of had as a hidden gem or maybe an underrated prospect in rounds 3 through 5, and he made a couple Pro Bowls in his career, and that really validated that scouting report. I know the nature of the beast means you're not going to hit on every prospect. I mean, it's just like the world of the NFL. So where do you look for those wins in draft projections and rankings and looking at what these players might do in the NFL?
Well, I think it's tough because there are really two different things that a draft analyst is responsible for, and that's the mock draft, you know, predicting which player is going to be drafted by which team, and then your big board, which is a ranking of how good you think the players are. Now, me personally, I would rather everyone looked at my big board and said, you know, like last year, I had Teddy Bridgewater at number one, but he was drafted at number 32, so that was not a hit. But how well did he play? Did he play like he was worthy of a number one pick? And it's something that you have to look at, you know, 1, 2, 3 years down the road. So it's tough to ask, I think, the casual fan to evaluate that, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, when a mock draft gives you that instant analysis. You know, people can look at my mock draft and Mel Kiper's mock draft, and it's easy to use that as a judging point to say, oh, well, Mel got every pick right in the top 10. He's better at his job than that is.
When right.
A mock draft is like picking lottery numbers. I mean, you know, it's so impossible to hit on, because, like, I have my final mock draft done. It's ready to go. And tomorrow night, the Titans could trade the number 2 pick, and everything will fall apart. So personally, I don't feel like there's a ton of value in being the guy who gets the most picks right. That's like, you know, it's a lot of luck that goes into that. I find the most value in being able to accurately evaluate players and predict how successful they will be. I think that there's two different skill sets there, and I personally think that being able to set a big board accurately is a lot more important.
Really interesting perspective, man. All right, let's move then to the specifics of the upcoming draft. Who, for you, we think Jameis Winston's pretty clearly going to go to number one. The Marcus Mariota trade rumors, is Cleveland offering 2 first-round picks to Tennessee? Are they not? There's conflicting reports out there today. Beyond those two guys, who is the most interesting player for you in this year's draft class?
Well, I think that Todd Gurley is probably the most interesting because, you know, here we have a running back, and that's a position that's supposedly devalued. He was suspended by the NCAA this year, which was kind of ridiculous, but he missed time for it. And then he tore his ACL in his first game back against Auburn. So you have all these things that work against him, and he still might be a top 10 pick. So I think Todd Gurley and how the NFL views him is going to be really interesting, you know, to see will a team in the top 10, whether that's Jacksonville or the Jets or the Falcons, will someone look at him as just how good is he of a player instead of looking at the position and drafting him based on that? So he's really kind of a case study, I think you could say. But after that, you know, there's Randy Gregory and Shane Ray, Dorial Green-Beckham, three players with different types of off-field issues. But it'll be really interesting to see how early they are drafted, because I think it'll say a lot about the state of the NFL if those three guys aren't drafted in the first round, because on talent they would be. But, you know, the NFL is so big on off-field issues right now and the spotlight that puts on the teams and on the players that, you know, those three guys who would probably be top 10 picks without off-field issues might not get drafted during the first round. So that's going to be one that gets talked about, I think, a lot over the next few days.
How far do you think you see them falling? I mean, especially when you look at the NFL now and the hyper-focus on personal conduct, on everything that we've been through last year. Now to have some of these first-round talents come in with questionable character issues, I think obviously, you know, those edge rushers might go a bit before Dorial Green-Beckham, but all it takes, Matt, as we know, is one team to pull the trigger and say, yeah, in spite of those red flags, this guy is worth risking a first-round pick on. So how far do you see those guys sliding, if maybe at all? Maybe there is a team that pulls the triggers. And do you think that there's one of those guys that teams might be more apt to go out and grab in spite of those issues than another?
Yeah, I think that's the hard part is knowing, because 31 teams could say, no, we're not drafting Dorial Green-Beckham in the first round. And one could say, hey, we feel like the risk versus reward is pretty good here, so we're going to go ahead and make him our pick. I think that DGB is the interesting one because he has the most issues, but he's also had the longest time period between the issues and now. So he has, you know, a year or more in the past where he's not had any issues, so that helps him out. He, I think, will still be a first-round pick, maybe mid-first-round. I think Shane Ray, you know, he has the foot injury. And to be honest, the people I've talked to in the NFL are more worried about the turf toe than they are about the citation for the marijuana, because he didn't fail the test at the combine like Randy Gregory did. There weren't strong rumors of pot use with him. So I think that what it all comes down to is, at the end of the first round, teams like Pittsburgh, Arizona, Carolina, Baltimore, they're going to have a hard time staying away from these off-field guys because the talent is so great. But I would be pretty surprised if we see Randy Gregory and Shane Ray and Dorial Green-Beckham all make it out of the first round.
Where do you see the strength in this year's draft class? We mentioned a couple of those guys. Our edge rushers, there's plenty of those in the first round. The receiver class is fairly strong. Where do you see the strength in position in this year's draft class?
Well, I think it's that edge rusher position. I have 6 guys with a first-round grade, which is pretty crazy. And you know, 4 of them are in the top 15, and then Bud Dupree from Kentucky is just right outside it. So it's very top-heavy, the edge rusher classes, but there's also good depth there. I mean, you talk about the receivers. The is another very good year for wide receivers, and it's a good year for running backs. You know, not just Todd Gurley, but Melvin Gordon will probably go in the first round, and then you have a good group in that second tier of Tevin Coleman and Duke Johnson and Amir Abdullah. There's a lot of really talented running backs. I think at the end of the day, I looked at this class and felt like there were 10 or 11 guys who had starting caliber potential at running back. So it's a very top-heavy and a very deep group there, too.
The quarterback position may be at the opposite end of the spectrum with Mariota, Winston, and then a lot of question marks afterwards. Is there a guy in that field of quarterbacks you think can develop into a starter one day beyond the top two? I know, you know, there's been some studies and some questions. Can you really develop a starter from those mid to late rounds, especially, you know, with some of the things that we've seen this year? And really the research shows beyond a couple special occasions, beyond, you know, the Tony Romos of the world and Tom Brady's, there's not that many starting quarterbacks that come beyond the first or second round. Russell Wilson might be another lone example. I think he was around 3 pick a few years ago. So is there a guy that can buck that trend and maybe be the next Wilson or Brady or Romo from the mid to late rounds at quarterback?
It's scary to compare anyone to those guys, you know, because the expectations are so high. But if I had to pick one, it'd be Bryce Petty from Baylor. And he may go early second round. I talked to teams. They're all over the place with this guy. I think I gave him a late round 2 grade. But, you know, in terms of football IQ, he's very, very high. His character's great. He's a good athlete. He has a strong arm. And those are a lot of the things that you look for in a baseline. You know, I mean, playing quarterback a lot of times just comes down to, you know, can you make the throw accurately and is your arm strong enough to get it there? You know, they too often we fall in love with guys who are athletic and can run and make crazy plays. But a lot of the best quarterbacks in the NFL are just big, strong guys who can throw the ball accurately. And I think that's where Penny would fall in and be that, you know, the guy who could, out of a 2 quarterback class, he could be the one that becomes a third starter.
I know we're kind of moving out of the draft analysis realm and moving into the rumors and trades realm, but your gut instinct, who is Marcus Mariota playing for next year?
I would say gut instinct, I think, is the Tennessee Titans. I do think they're going to do everything they can to trade that pick, but at the end of the day, I think the asking price is going to be too high, so I think they'll stay put.
Interesting. And then finally, selfishly, I have to get you out of here on this one. My Saints, 2 first-round draft picks, 13, 31. Who do you have them getting in your final mock draft projection and why?
Well, at 13, I had Brandon Scherff, the guard from Iowa, falling to them. And with the trade of Ingrams and how much Drew Brees likes to step up in the pocket, I thought that pick is a logical one for them. I know fans want them to go all defense all the time this year, but improving the offensive line support there. And then at pick 31, I had them going defense with Eli Harrell, the edge rusher from Virginia. Really productive guy. I had the quickness to get into the backfield, can play outside linebacker opposite Junior Glutz, so filling out some of those needs. And it's a deep draft in the right places for the Saints. So, you know, when they come back around in round 2, they can, you know, address receiver or corner, and they've got a couple picks in round 3. So they're in a good spot this year.
I like it. Give me something optimistic, something to cling to on Thursday night. All right, Matt, great insights on the draft, on Bleacher Report, on this world of draft analysis. Really appreciate everyone out there. Give a follow to Matt on Twitter at NFL Draft Scout. Check out that last mock draft and definitely follow along for the draft coverage from Chicago. Matt, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up again soon.
That's great. Thanks so much.